the next speaker is Matt Leifer, who's currently still at Perimeter Institute, although soon to be at Chapman University. And he's going to tell us about Harinov meets Speckens. What do quantum paradoxes tell us about the nature of reality?
Okay, thanks, Lucien. Yeah, so what I want to tell you about today is a bit of an old story, actually. And since Convergence is supposed to be partly an alumni conference, it actually goes back to the first, when I first arrived at Perimeter Institute, I started working on the interpretation of these logical pre and post selection paradoxes with Rob Speckens. And we found some results and we published some papers about it, but there were still some unanswered questions, some mystery about it. And recently, we didn't do anything about it for 10 years, but recently Matt Pusey, who's sitting over here, is my collaborator on this work, came up with the insight that allowed us to basically finish this work. So that's what I want to talk about. So the talk's called Harinov meets Speckens. So Harinov is famous for, well, one of his slogans is progress through paradox. You can find it in at the beginning of the book he wrote with Danny Röhlich. The idea here is that if we come up with effects which challenge our conventional wisdom about quantum theory, then they're going to force us to think more deeply about it and come up with a better understanding of quantum reality. So here's just some of these are fairly recent examples of Harinov's paradoxes. The one I'm going to focus on today is a class of paradoxes that Rob and I called logical pre and post selection paradoxes. And actually these first two here, those are both examples of logical pre and post selection paradoxes. I'm probably not going to define what a logical pre and post selection paradox is because it's fairly boring to do so, but I will go through with the example of the three box paradox. So the first thing to say about this is that there's always been a certain amount of controversy about these sorts of effects. So you can find a lot of debates in the literature where people are arguing about whether these are really quantum or whether these are have classical analogs. So are these quantum effects or classical effects? And there's a lot of argument about that. The problem with that debate, though, is that it's completely meaningless. So in my view, the words quantum and classical are probably the two most meaningless words in physics that we use. Because there's a sense in which absolutely everything, every physical phenomena in the entire universe is quantum, and there's a sense in which absolutely every physical phenomena in the universe is classical. So to illustrate those extremes, we know since the very beginning of quantum theory that classical physics is inconsistent. For example, if we know that the atom has roughly the structure that Rutherford discovered, and we employ Maxwell's equations and Newton's equations, we'll find that the atom would be unstable, so everything would dissolve into radiation. Okay. So in some sense, the very fact that there is anything to observe at all, the very fact that we can build a measurement device to observe anything, is a quantum phenomenon. Okay. So in that sense, everything's quantum. But in other senses, everything's classical, because some people say that something is classical if you just use classical probability theory to describe it, right? So there are interpretations of quantum theory that just use classical probability theory. Bohmian mechanics is an example of that. And some people call Bohmian mechanics classical as an insult because of that. So in that sense, since that can account for all quantum phenomena, all quantum phenomena are classical. So basically, there is no sort of uninterpreted meaning of these two words. That's the point I want to make. What it depends on is how many assumptions you're going to make about your classical models. Yeah.
Bohmian mechanics also contains the wave function.
Sure, sure. But the definition of classical, the sort of very weak definition of classical I'm using in that sense is, are the probabilities in the model ordinary classical probabilities? Right. It's a notion of classicality that some people employ, right? So the point is that there's no sort of set scale of where there's sort of a definite cutoff between classical and quantum. It's how many assumptions are you making about your model? So, for example, in order to prove that the stability of the atom is classical, is quantum, sorry, I needed quite a lot of assumptions. I needed to use this. You need to use the specific form of Maxwell's equations. You need to know roughly what the structure of the atom is, etc. It's a lot of assumptions are involved. Whereas, for example, if we think about something like Bell's theorem, for example, it rules out classical models with far fewer assumptions. So depending on how many assumptions you have, various phenomena that we observe, yeah.
Why is non-locality considered a non-classical property?
Why is it considered a non-classical? Well, okay, so the point...
I'm just emphasizing your point.
You are emphasizing my point, but if you, you know, it's a question, what I'm trying to say here is that a lot of this is just a question of terminology. So some people would say, okay, these kind of ontological models to which Bell's theorem applies, those are classical, they have definite states of reality, they employ classical probability theory. And then we add some assumptions to that, we add an assumption about locality on top of that, and we derive a contradiction with quantum theory. So if that collection of assumptions is your definition of classical, then it's a genuinely quantum phenomenon. The only point I'm trying to make is the sort of number of assumptions you're making about the physics in that case is sort of more towards this end of the scale than this one. Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't at all disagree with this, but I think it's a much more general phenomenon. The same issues arise in gravity in connection with the idea of generally covariant, right?
Sure. All I'm trying to do with this is point out that, you know, people write a lot of papers saying, accusing certain things of being classical or arguing that they're quantum. What I'm trying to point out here is that that's not, these are often written as if these words were meaningful on their own.
Maybe we could say that unless they provide their own definition of classicality, the statement is empty.
Right, but there is nonetheless still, and this is what I want to emphasize, there is still a question to be answered here. So given any specific phenomenon in, say, quantum physics, you can now ask the question, well, what's the smallest set of assumptions, what's the minimal set of assumptions about my classical models I can make such that would prove that would put that phenomenon on the quantum side. So once you've done that, you can then argue about the validity of those assumptions. But kind of it's sort of an interesting thing to do given a particular phenomenon. Try and figure out what's that minimal set of assumptions. Okay, so that's what I'm trying to do here. So Rob Speckens has come up with what I would say is a sort of an interesting set of assumptions to look at. In his work, he's shown that there's a vast array of quantum phenomena that would otherwise be puzzling that you could explain in classical models, by which I mean just classical probabilistic models in this case, where there's a restriction on how much you can know about the system. I'm not going to go into that in any detail, but we can sort of adopt that as a sort of rough definition of what we mean by classical in this context. However, there's another set of phenomena which, when you try to model them in this way, you end up showing this phenomenon of contextuality. So contextuality you might have heard of in the context of the Cauchy-Speicher theorem, but Rob has come up with a generalization of that, which is, in some sense, more well-founded. It's certainly more experimentally testable. So I call that notion of contextuality after Speckens contextuality. This is just so that we can call the old version of contextuality before Speckens contextuality, or BS contextuality.
Just to make sure, it's debatable whether it has any experimental meaning.
It's debatable whether BS contextuality has any experimental reasoning. I would argue, so Rob has published a couple of papers about experimentally testing AS contextuality, recently, just in the last couple of weeks.
So
I would argue that that does have an experimental meaning, but we can debate it later.
Let's say there is a difference.
Okay. So what I want to do is I want to look at these logical pre and post selection paradoxes sort of in this light. Can they be modeled, you know, by a classical probabilistic model with just a restriction on how much you can know? If not, are they proofs of contextuality? We will end up showing the latter eventually, but I first want to tell you about sort of the old way that we approached this before. So we were looking at this originally in terms of the before Speckens definition of contextuality. So first of all, I have to at least give you an example of what the logical pre and post selection paradox is. And the simplest one is this three box paradox that was proposed by Aronov and Weidman back in 91. As Sandy was talking about earlier, this is an effect that occurs for pre and post selected systems, right? So at the beginning of the experiment, we prepare some state psi. Right at the end of the experiment, we do a measurement to check if the system is in the state phi. So you measure in some basis that includes phi. If you find phi, then you keep that run of the experiment, you keep the statistics. If you find something else, then you throw the whole thing away. And so you're just looking at the probabilities for some measurement in the middle, which is just going to be an ordinary projective measurement with projection postulate state update in the middle. You're looking at the probabilities for these measurement outcomes given the pre-selection and the fact that the post-selection succeeded. Okay, so then you can get some sort of funny effects. And so here's one. So if we have a three-dimensional Hilbert space, which for the sake of having a good story, we will can think of as there's a ball that can be in one of three boxes. Okay, so state one represents the state where the ball is in box one, similarly for two and three. So if we're able to prepare the system in a superposition, equal superposition of being in all three boxes, and if we post-select in another equal superposition, except with a different phase on three, so you get a negative phase on three. Then in the middle, we're going to make one of two measurements. We're going to either check whether the ball is in box one, or we're going to check whether it's in box two. Okay, so if we're checking whether the ball is in box one, that corresponds to these two projectors. So we have the projector onto the state one versus the coarse-grained projector onto the other subspace. Similarly for the box two measurement. Now it's very easy to see, even without using the formula that Sandy wrote down earlier, that the probability of finding the ball in box one, if you make this measurement, is one, and the probability of it finding it in box two is one in this case. So let me just explain the reason for that. So if you consider this measurement first and look at this measurement outcome, the two or three measurement outcome, if you take this state and you project it onto the two or three subspace, I'll get two plus three. That state is orthogonal to this post-selection state because that's got a two minus three term there. So if I were to get this outcome, then the post-selection would always fail. Okay, so the fact that we know that the post-selection succeeded tells us that it must have been this outcome. Right, the same argument holds down here. If I project this onto the 1 or 3 subspace, I get 1 plus 3, but that's orthogonal to the 1 minus 3 term here, so that must have probability 0. Is there a question from Raphael?
Just a comment. If you're finished describing it. So
yeah.
This is isomorphic mathematically to what some of us call the three-slit paradox, mm-hmm. which is curves and three-slit diffraction.
Yeah.
In that context, we take it to show that quantum reality should not be consistently described by a single history as it is passing.
Well,
that's
one of the questions: is can we establish something like that?
Yeah.
So naively, if looking at these probabilities, you might say, okay, well, there's some sense in which the ball is both in box one and in box two at the same time. However, there's this post-selection, so you might be worried that there's some funny effect that goes on with post-selection that makes that kind of conclusion invalid. So that's the kind of question that we're going to ask. But before we do that, I want to talk about a connection with the old definition of contextuality, the BS contextuality that Rob and I found back in 2004 or so. Okay, so for those of you who don't know about this, the old definition of contextuality consists of, well, it's, okay, so first of all, I want to say that for this section of the talk, please forget everything I've said about post-selection, right? So this part of the talk has nothing to do with post-selection. I just have a system at a given time, and there are various measurements I can make on it, and we're going to look at various properties that the system has. So the definition of non-contextuality, it applies to a certain kind of what we now like to call ontological model, but what used to be called hidden variable theory. And basically, this is a special kind of hidden variable theory which says that any given time, the system should have a definite value for every single observable. Okay, so every observable gets a particular value. We can debate whether that's reasonable or not. This is just a particular class of theories you could consider. So in particular, if you're talking about orthonormal basis measurements, that means for each basis, precisely one of the orthonormal basis vectors has to be singled out as the one that that you'll get the outcome for definite. So we should be able to assign the value 1 to a single basis vector and 0 to the rest. And then there's the assumption of non-contextuality, which is that the outcome that you assign to an observable shouldn't depend on whatever else you measure with it. So if I measure an observable, I can measure also other commuting observables at the same time, and which of those observables I choose to measure shouldn't affect the outcome I get. So in terms of basis vector measurements, again, this means that the value is assigned to a basis vector shouldn't depend on which basis you've chosen to measure. So if we choose to measure this basis or this basis, then the value that gets assigned to the basis vector 1 must be the same. Okay, so back in a long time ago, Koshin and Specker showed that you can't do this in quantum theory. Okay, so but what I want to do is look at a very specific proof of contextuality, which happens to be related to the three-box paradox, and this is one that was first proposed by Rob Clifton in 93 or so. It's known as a statistical proof of contextuality. So what this diagram here is it's an orthogonality diagram of a set of vectors in Hilbert space. Okay, so the nodes of this graph, they represent vectors, states in Hilbert space, and they are connected by an edge if and only if the vectors are orthogonal. Okay. So I haven't shown you that there exists a set of vectors with this orthogonality relations. Let's just assume that for now. Now this will allow us...
Is this three-dimensional?
This is a three-dimensional Hilbert space. Yeah, it's important, right. So in particular, these triangles here, those are complete orthonormal bases. But if I don't have a triangle, then it's just an orthogonality. Right, so one thing we know. So we want a theory that's both non-contextual and can reproduce the predictions of quantum theory. So one thing we know is I could always prepare the system in a state that corresponds to this vector here. If I do that and I make a measurement which includes this basis vector, I will always get the outcome. So that means that there must be some hidden variable states which assign the value 1 to this guy. Right. In fact, all the hidden variable states in the support of the distribution corresponding to that state. However, this state is orthogonal, is non-orthogonal to this one. There's no edge there. And the other thing I know from quantum theory is if I prepare this state and make this measurement, then sometimes I get the outcome. So that means that some of the states in the support of this guy, all of which assign value 1 to here, must also assign value 1 to there. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to sometimes obtain that outcome. Okay, so we know that that must be true. There must be states which assign, there must be hidden variable states that assign value 1 to both of these guys. Now we have a problem because if we look at this top triangle, this state here is orthogonal to that one. So if this is assigned value 1, that has to be assigned value 0. Similarly, if this one's assigned value 1, that one has to be assigned value 0. But this is a complete orthonormal basis. So one of these three has to be assigned the value 1. So it must be this one. But now we have the same argument down here. these two must be assigned value 0, so that one's assigned value 1. Now we have two orthogonal states that are both assigned the value 1, which wasn't allowed. Okay, so this shows a contradiction with the assumptions of non-contextuality. So why have I bothered to show you this proof? This is the reason. Here's the set of vectors, here's a set of vectors in a three-dimensional Hilbert space that satisfy those orthogonality relations. And you will notice that this is precisely the pre-selection vector in the three-box paradox. This is the post-selection vector. And here, if we make the one intermediate measurement, we have the projector onto one, and these two states are just the fine graining of the projector onto the two versus three subspace. Okay, so one thing we showed, what we showed back in our 2005 paper is for this whole class of logical pre and post-selection paradoxes, there's always a proof of contextuality that's related to it. So does this mean that the pre and post-selection paradox itself is a proof of contextuality? Well, it's not obvious because it's a different setup, right? Here, I'm just talking about different alternative measurements that you can make at the same time, whereas previously I was talking about a sequence of measurements with post-selection. Okay, so even though there's this connection, it's slightly mysterious because what you can show is that, in fact, those logical pre- and post-selection paradoxes have models which aren't contextual. They have non-contextual models. And the reason why they have non-contextual models is because what you expect is that measurements can disturb the state of the system. So what can happen is that different measurements will disturb the state of the system in different ways, and that can affect the probability of the post-selection passing. So you can sort of mimic the effects of contextuality by something that appears to be, on first sight, non-contextual, just a measurement disturbance. So I'm going to give you an example of that. So first of all, I'm going to give you a model which is close to the three-box paradox, but doesn't predict exactly the same predictions, just to build intuition. But then I'm going to show you that you can upgrade the model so that it gives you the predictions exactly. Okay, so the idea here, and again, this is something that we proposed all the way back in 2005. The idea here is, now this is just a classical system, which we can think of as a box. The box is sort of, in our heads, we divide the box into four different sections, left front, right front, left back, and right back, okay? And somewhere in this box is a ball, okay? And we're going to pre-select the system so that we know that it's in the front. We know with certainty that it's in the front, so there's probability of half of being in left front, probability of half of being in right front. And then at the very end of the experiment, we're going to do a post-selection, which is to just check whether the ball is at the back, okay? So now I'm going to consider two measurements that we could do in the middle. One I'm going to call the left measurement and one I'm going to call the right measurement. Both of these are methods of determining whether the ball is on the left or the right, but they're slightly different. Okay, so basically how this works is I'm going to put in a double partition, splitting the box into two left and right pieces. Imagine that this box is opaque, by the way, so I can't directly see inside it. So now I've got these two components, and I'm just going to shake the left-hand side. Okay, and then if I hear the ball rattle, I know it was on the left, and if I don't hear anything, I know it was on the right. Right. Similarly, for the right measurement, I'm going to do exactly the same thing, except this time I'm going to shake the right-hand component. So if I hear it rattling, I know it's on the right, and if I don't hear anything, then I know it was on the left. The point is that these two ways of doing the measurement have different disturbance. So if the ball happens to be on the left and I do this measurement, then I'll hear it rattle. But because I've shaken the ball, I no longer know whether it's at the back or the front. Okay, so the back front position is going to get randomized. I'll know it's on the left, but I won't know whether it's in the back or the front. However, if I do the right measurement and I shake this part, nothing happens to the ball. It stays at the front. Okay, and similarly, the opposite will happen if the ball is on the right. Okay, so in that case, in this measurement, the ball won't get disturbed, it stays at the front, and in this case, it gets randomized. So now, if we look at the probabilities for the two different measurement outcomes given this pre and post selection, what we can see is that if you do the left measurement, you'll definitely get the left outcome. And if you do the right measurement, you'll definitely get the right outcome. Because we're conditioning on this post selection. And what that means is that at some point during the course of what we've done, during the course of the measurement, the ball must have transitioned from the front to the back. The only way it can transition from the front to the back is if it gets disturbed in the intermediate measurement. And in the left measurement, it only gets disturbed if it's on the left. In the right measurement, it only gets disturbed if it's on the right. Okay. So therefore, the probability of getting the left conditioned on pre and post selection is one here, and the probability of getting right conditioned on pre and post selection is one there. Okay, this model is in some sense non-contextual. Well, I mean, we have to be a bit careful about that, but it's certainly not the case that there's any sense in which the ball is in both boxes in this kind of model. What I mean is there's no sense in which the ball is both on the left and on the right at the same time. Now, you might say to me, okay, that's all very nice, but this doesn't exactly reproduce the predictions we had before. In particular, in the quantum experiment, the pre and post selection were non-orthogonal. So if I make this pre-selection and do this post-selection, then there's some probability, and I don't do a measurement in the middle, then there's some probability of the post-selection succeeding. Whereas in this model, that's not the case. The pre and post-selection have no overlap. So I say, okay, let me just modify the model a bit. What I can do is make my box slightly bigger, add two new chambers to it, and I can have the pre and post selection overlap on this box. Okay. Now I'm going to check at the end whether I'm in one of these three boxes, and there's some overlap here, so there's some probability of the post selection succeeding. Now I can also, it's quite boring to go through the details, but I can change the relative probabilities of being in these three boxes in order to make the probability of being in this box exactly match the quantum probability that I would get. Now we have a slight problem, because if I do the measurements just like I did before, so in this model we needed it to be the case that the only way the post selection could succeed is if the intermediate measurements disturbs the position of the ball. Right? That's how we made the inference. So I need to do something else, because now there's two reasons why the post-selection could succeed. One, it could be because the ball transitions from the front to the back, or it could be just because I'm in this box. Now that's very relatively easy to fix. I just add to the state update rules the condition that these two boxes always get swapped. So whenever I make a measurement of any sort, I'm just gonna say that if the ball is over here, it transitions to the back, and if it's over here, it transitions to the front. And that means that the post-selection can't possibly succeed because of this overlap. It's a funny trick, right? It seems like a very weird thing to do. The question is this a weird thing to do? Okay, and this is where the new upgraded version of contextuality comes in. So it turns out that this model is still measurement non-contextual in the sense that the ball really is in one of these three sections at any given time, but only at the expense of having this funny state update rule. And it turns out that that funny state update rule is contextual, and indeed any state update rule that can reproduce the three box paradox has to be contextual in Rob Speckin's sense. So let's just briefly have a look at that. How long have I got, by the way, Lucy?
You started about 10 minutes late, so you've got including questions you've got.
Well, so
let's
have you
finish it
fast. Okay.
And then we'll have questions.
I'll do my best. Okay.
Or you can maybe take another.
Yeah.
It will be
fine. Okay. So the Speckin's notion of contextuality it remedies several deficiencies in the standard notion of contextuality. Two things it does. One is that now the notion of contextuality can be applied to arbitrary theories, arbitrary operational theories, not just quantum theory. And it doesn't assume outcome determinism. So we're just using a non-contextuality assumption, and it applies beyond just deterministic theories. So I basically briefly have to tell you what an operational theory is. So this is a bit of a cartoon of what it is. But what you can imagine is in your lab, you've got some experimental apparatus. So I've got some preparation device, which has a knob on it. I can choose to set this, to prepare the system in different ways. Okay, so I'm going to choose, call the knob setting P. You then have a transformation device. This has some input and output. Again, it has a setting, which we call T. And then at the end, we have a measurement device. So this also has a setting, and it displays some outcome on the screen, right? So the goal of an operational theory is to just, for every choice of the experimental settings, PM and T, just give you a probability distribution for the measurement outcomes. So in particular, if we view quantum theory in this way, then preparations get mapped to get correspond to density operators. Transformations in general correspond to completely positive trace-preserving maps, of which unitary dynamics and the state update rules you have in measurements, they're specific examples of that. And measurements correspond in general to positive operator valued measures, or the projective measurements that we were using before, again, a special case of that. However, what we're interested in is sort of underlying realist models. Okay, so we're going to assume that the system has some real physical properties, which following Bell we're going to call lambda, and we want to see how we can reproduce these predictions in terms of that. Okay, so between preparation and transformation, the system has some properties lambda. That might get modified by the transformation, so later on we have some lambda prime. And how are we going to represent these things? Well, preparation, we're not going to assume it has full control of lambda. So in general, a preparation will correspond to some probability measure over the values of lambda. A measurement is going to correspond to a set of conditional probabilities for the measurement outcomes given the values of lambda. A transformation, which I don't have a nice way of visualizing, that's just going to be a stochastic map in general. Okay, so for every value of lambda, we're going to specify a probability measure over which values of lambda prime it might be in the future. And then we just demand that this thing should reproduce the predictions of the operational theory. So here I'm just averaging over the initial probability measure, applying the stochastic map, and putting in the conditional probabilities for the measurement outcomes. So it's a very general framework for how you might want to model this in terms of states of reality. Okay, so now we want to impose non-contextuality on this model. And so Rob's basic idea of non-contextuality is that whenever you have two things that are indistinguishable operationally, so every single experiment that you can do doesn't distinguish between them, then they should be represented the same way in this ontological model. And in fact, if you can apply this definition to preparations, transformations, and measurements, okay, I'm not going to go into the preparation measurement case very much, but the only thing I want to say about it is that in the specific case of quantum theory, if you apply those definitions to preparations and measurements, then you end up, as a consequence, deriving the old notion of non-contextuality as a special case. So following from Rob's framework, we can say that that a non-contextual theory for projective measurements has to be outcome deterministic and non-contextual in the old sense. So we can just use that. However, the interesting bit from our point of view is that there's also this notion of transformation non-contextual reality. So if I have two transformations T and S, and it turns out that for all possible preparations and measurements I can do, they always predict the exact same probabilities, that means there's no experiment I can do to tell the difference between those two transformations, then the non-contextuality requirement is that they should be represented by the same stochastic map. Okay, that's what we're going to use. So in quantum theory, that in particular means that this stochastic map can only depend on the completely positive map that your transformation is represented by, and not on anything else, because if it's represented by the same completely positive map, it has the same predictions. Okay, so now we have a theorem. What we're going to do is we're going to look at the completely positive maps associated to non-selective state update rules. Okay, so if I make a projective measurement and don't record what the outcome is, then von Neumann tells us that the state of the system gets updated in this sort of way. We just average over all of the projectors. Now, it turns out that what you can show is that these maps always can alternatively be written in this way. So with some probability, some positive probability, you do absolutely nothing to the system. And with some other, and with some probability 1 minus p, you do some other trace-preserving completely positive map. Right? So there's always a way of implementing this map. Instead of by doing a measurement, you can just flip a coin and either do nothing or do something else. The important point is that these measurement maps can be implemented by in a different way, where you sometimes do absolutely nothing to the system. So by measurement non-contextuality, it means that when you make one of these measurements, with some probability, absolutely nothing has to happen to the system. Okay. So the only special case we need for the three-box paradox, remember the intermediate measurements in the three-box paradox, they're two outcome measurements. So I just need that special case. It's relatively easy to generalize. Here's how you prove it. So if you take a unitary operator, which is just the sum of the two projectors, that's just the identity. If you take the difference of the two projectors, that's also unitary. If it's easy to see that because if you just write all these in a basis where everything's, these are diagonal in the same basis, then in that basis, you just have a diagonal operator. This unitary is just a diagonal operator with some ones and some minus ones on the diagonal. That's also unitary. Then if you write down this completely positive map here, well, the first term's obviously just the identity, so it does that. And then you have this other unitary. Because of this difference of sign here, if you multiply this out, the cross terms will disappear and you'll get something that looks like this. So that's sort of how you show that, that these maps have something that looks like that. Okay, so now, and this is sort of the end of the story, we can go back to this Clifton proof and say that instead of being a different scenario to the three-box paradox, we can now make this a proof of contextuality for the actual predictions of the three-box paradox itself with pre- and post-selection. Okay. So now we're going to use the logical pre- and post-selection paradox predictions to prove contextuality. So what we're going to do is first assume measurement non-contextuality in the old sense, but also transformation non-contextuality, and derive a contradiction with the predictions. So as before, what we're going to do is we're going to look at the sort of hidden variable state of the system immediately after the system is prepared. Okay. So if you prepare the system in this state, then again, it must assign value 1 to this guy. Now, we also know that there are some states within the support of this guy that assign probability 1 to that guy, because the post-selection sometimes succeeds. Okay, so we know that there must be hidden variable states like this. But the other thing we know is if we have measurement non-contextuality, then with some probability p, the measurement doesn't change the state of the system at all. Okay, right. So what that means is that because whenever you pre-select and post-select in the system, you always get this outcome in the pre- and post-selection measurement. And because we know that sometimes the state doesn't get disturbed, the only way you can reproduce that is if always you assign value 1 to that outcome, right? Because with probability p, there's not going to be any disturbance, right, at all. Right? And so the only way that I can get probability 1, I always get this outcome, is even in the case of no disturbance, I must assign value 1 there. Same is true for this. So just from the logical pre- and post-selection predictions themselves, we get a contradiction. So what we end up saying is that in any model of a logical pre- and post-selection paradox, or three-box paradox in particular, we have some choices. We can say that the model, we can model it with measurement contextuality. We can keep transformation non-contextuality and say the model's measurement contextual. Or we can drop the transformation non-contextuality. We can have a transformation non-contextual model, which has a state update rule that's contextual. That's contextual. And indeed, that's what was happening in this particular model. So in this model, we always swap these two whenever you do a measurement. And that's contextual because we showed that in a projective measurement, you sometimes have to do absolutely nothing. Okay, so we can trade those two things, but you can't get rid of contextuality completely. So now that's the end of the story. These things are proofs of contextuality in the generalized spec and sense. Okay, so just to conclude, I started off by saying, and I think it's important to realize that there isn't such a thing as classical or genuinely quantum phenomena without doing two things. So first of all, I emphasize that you need to specify the assumptions that you're making about your classical models. But another thing which sort of came up during the talk is it's very important to specify which aspects of the phenomenon you want to reproduce. And this often gets lost in these debates as well. So if you remember, in the model for the in the sort of partitioned box model, if all I wanted to do was come up with a situation where two mutually exclusive things both get probability one in pre and post selection, I can do that in a totally non-contextual way. But it's only when I also said yes and the pre and post selection had to overlap that you necessarily had to get this transformation contextuality. So you know, you can't just say sort of logical pre and post selection paradoxes, you have to specify which features of the quantum predictions. So, you know, the exact same phenomenon might be classified as both classical or quantum, depending on which assumptions you're making. So for example, if you're looking at the phenomena of quantum interference, if you sort of say, well, I just want something that sort of qualitatively has this constructive, destructive type of behavior, versus if you say, no, I actually want the exact quantum predictions for the visibility fringes, you may end up getting different answers for that. So I think a well-motivated set of assumptions, and Rob has done a lot more to motivate them than I have in this talk. You should read his papers to understand why. If you can understand a phenomenon in a non-contextual probabilistic theory with a restrictional knowledge, you might want to call that classical in inverted commas, or however, things that are contextual, you might want to call quantum. I would argue that it's a sort of very broad, if your quantum in this sense, it's sort of one of the sort of strongest notions of something being genuinely quantum that you could have. Okay, so I'll finish there, thanks.
Time for questions.
I like this proof very much. However, there's one step, it's not peculiar to this, but one sees it over and over again. And
yeah.
Whenever I see it, it always bothers me a little bit. I don't know if I should be bothered, but I'll tell you what it is that bothers me. And you said that you can realize this particular transformation by flipping a coin, and depending on the outcome, either doing one thing or doing nothing, I guess, in that particular case. But then somehow you have to forget what the result of the coin flip was. And if you remember what it is, then you know exactly whether you've done something or you have done something.
I mean, it doesn't matter if it's you doing the coin flip or you imagine that the coin flip is happening inside the black box. It doesn't matter if you are actually recording it or not.
Well, but if you want it to be, can you reformulate everything without having that? I mean, if you wanted it to be operational and you reformulate it in such a way, then that would be fine. That would erase my worry.
So, okay. I mean, I think the worry here is about convexity, basically, and this is something that often comes up in the context of contextuality, of these contextuality proofs, right? So I think we'd all agree that the identity superoperator, or doing nothing to the system, has to be represented by doing nothing to the system in the ontological model. That part, I mean, we can argue for on the basis of non-contextuality anyway. And then there's a further assumption, which is that if you take a mixture of that with something else, then in the ontological model, I have to take a mixture of doing nothing with something else. Right, so some of these, I'm not sure in the context of transformations because I haven't thought about it too much, but some of these things, Rob may have a comment on this, some of these things can be motivated from an assumption of non-contextuality itself. Is that the case here with transformations?
I think so, yeah. The way I would put it is, imagine you're just doing a transformation, that's one case. And here over here, I'm doing a transformation after I flipped a coin and seen heads. Okay? And then I say, all right, now let me do my whole battery of measurements on these two procedures. Let me see if I see any difference in statistics. Oh, lo and behold, perceiving the transformation with the coin flip that comes up heads doesn't change any of the statistics. Then, strictly speaking, those two things are operationally equivalent. It's a transformation on textuality says I should represent them the same way.
I'm not quite sure I follow that, but...
if you see heads, doesn't that tell you...
I know we've discussed this in the context of preparations. I was just wondering whether it also holds in the transformation case. But
what's wrong with the argument?
Well, you didn't. I mean, you just talked about doing some channel versus doing some channel and post-selecting on heads. You didn't mention that there's a correlation with the what channel you do in the coin flip. In what you just said.
I'm just saying that a given channel implemented on its own, and a given channel conditioned on something happening, could be found to be operationally equivalent.
Right.
And if so, then they should be represented in the same way.
Yeah, okay.
And I think that covers...
I buy it.
...the word.
Like you're saying, if you just do something, or if you do something because you saw ahead, those are equivalent. That's the statement. But why does that imply that the mixture, the convex mixture?
Well, and the point is the convex mixture is something. It's some channel, right? Then we can also look at sort of the sub-channel where you observed heads, and that's the case where you did sort of nothing, and observe that...
Oh, that's where you did nothing.
And observe that those two things, so that's operationally equivalent with the identity.
Yeah.
So it has to be represented the same way as the identity. Well,
this is very nice, and certainly I'm not going to argue with you, especially since you said that our paradoxes are quantum, the strongest definition. So, okay, yeah, that's fine. But there is something that makes me always. There's one thing that one should not forget. In this thing, I'm sure this is extremely valuable, but there is one thing one should not forget is think of how should I formulate it? Try to see what else is there in physics. So, for example, this is an ad hoc model of saying it, but I would like to ask what happens if you open the third one. Since I know for sure that the particle is in box one, since I know for sure it is in box two, I would presume, and since I know for sure that there is only one particle, what would you imagine that you'll find in box three?
Well, I mean, in what we discuss, I mean, I'm only discussing the strong measurement version here. Right.
No, but physics is in the entire set
well, then,
that you want to do.
Then in the quantum case, I think, I mean, there's some probability of finding it in box three if you do that measurement.
Okay, and if you couple with it slightly weaker,
okay.
What will you find?
So now you're moving to the weak measurement case. And I did have a slide on that, but I
tell you what you'll find minus one.
Yeah. So
every single interaction would behave as if there is minus one particle. So you should not forget that, you do physics and you see. So it's important that you want a robust thing that can give you intuitions for what happens when you change a little bit the situation. And otherwise it's very ad hoc.
Well, I mean, so... one thing I'll point out now is that obviously, this weak measurement stuff is has itself generated a lot of controversy over what are the interpretations.
That is irrelevant. People can controversy on whatever they want.
So you can, I mean, so, you know, and in fact, there was sort of some recent debate about that here at Perimeter Institute, as you know.
Well, the question is the observation.
I'm going to say you can have sort of, so again, you know, this is one of the reasons why I'm so careful about this sort of classical quantum distinction. You can come up with models which reproduce that phenomena and aren't particularly strange.
No, look, that's not the issue. The issue is, while you do this particular model, do you have an intuition of what will happen when you do something else on the system? Of course, for every time when I give you an experiment, you can concoct some other ad hoc model, but the question is whether there is some continuity. Would this have told you that if I come now and I weakly bring a gravitational probe next to particle 3, I will see that being repelled from that box?
Well, no, I wasn't trying to address that. But I mean, the thing is, it's okay. But what we're trying to do here is, well, it's something different. I mean, sort of, I'm not arguing that whole formalism of weak measurements and weak values isn't valuable or you know, insightful in some way, useful for predictions. I'm not arguing against any of those kinds of things. We're just trying here to resolve a debate, which is, you know, what is the minimal set of assumptions under which you can say that there's something strange going on?
Of course, I don't know nothing with this, but the question is, a model is good if it gives you some intuition of how to go forward. And this is something that I'm missing here. I really appreciate that the result. It's fine. I'm no doubt about that. Again, I would be more against it if you could say I'm not fine. but do you get any intuition for what happens? And that seems to me not, at least not at this stage.
Well, I think, you know, one way of addressing that is, so there is a similar proof which Matt Pusey has done for showing that you get contextuality from these anomalous weak values. What's missing from that kind of work is there's no interpretation of what the value of the weak value is. We just end up saying, okay, this is contextual, but it doesn't tell you what how far outside the eigenvalue range you are is measuring. What kind of thing does that correspond to? So that I would agree that that's a missing piece, but that maybe is something that we can try to further look at with these kinds of tools.
Is it a short point?
It is short.
Okay, we'll take that point and then we'll.
And it connects to what Tanya said. So Matt, you emphasized earlier that, you know, one of the general points here is that increase the professionalism of any discussion or debate about, you know, whether something's classical or quantum, it's good to start out with a mathematically well-defined notion of classicality and then find a mathematical proof of, you know, some features that highlight that. So I think another point you can make that's very general is that, and furthermore, that kind of thing that is either classical or non-classical is, what do you call it, a data table. I have a set of different preparations, a set of different transformations, a set of different measurements, and I tell you what are all the, you know, statistics are. Because I think you could think of this story here as a criticism of, if somebody says, okay, what's quantum about the three box paradoxes, and I can find the pre and post selection, and I can find two intermediate measurements that give me probability one for D and box one and box two, then I think it's a valid criticism to say, hey, you forgot the caveat that the pre and post selection have to be non-orthogonal. You can't just come along afterwards and say, oh yeah, of course they have to be non-orthogonal. No, you have to write that down and say that's part of the surprise. And if I can find a single model that I can make unsurprising because, you know, for the original list, I've shown that the original list was incomplete. And so even now there's sort of work to be done because, you know, you've assumed ideal preparations, measurements, and all the correlations are perfect. But what you'd really like to say is, you know, only if the, you know, pre and post select probabilities are above some threshold with this amount of non-orthogonality, then it's surprising, and if not, it isn't.
Yeah, I mean, actually, It's a bit funny because it turns out that in quantum theory, I suppose we have a theory independent definition of what a logical pre and post selection paradox is, which, you know, not sure that we quite do yet. But in quantum theory, it turns out that you can only get a logical pre- and post-selection paradox if the pre- and post-selection are non-orthogonal. In other theories, as we've seen with the partition box thing, it's not true. So that is, you know, the fact that that inference holds is a special feature of quantum theory. Without that, you wouldn't get the proof. So that you can point out, you could say that it's that connection between the logical contradiction stuff and the non-orthogonality that's behind it. But yeah, I agree with you. It's a question of specifying precisely which are the minimal features of, I guess, of the data table, if you like, of the quantum phenomena that are needed to derive the contradiction.
We better stop there. Let's thank Matt again.